Okay, now we've got those formalities out of the way. Welcome everybody to the SEBPC update number one. In this session, we're going to go through a few items around notional tax contributions and the super guarantee ordinary time earnings and notional earnings base and a few other miscellaneous issues. So welcome along. We have two speakers today from the practice committee. Brad Jeffrey is a director of Watson White and is the senior actuary for the business. Been in the industry for over 28 years. And has been a wide speaker in the industry on various topics. And Paul Chaloux is a principal with Mercer, who's also been advising employers and trustees, for those of you who attended the last session, on superannuation and related, in the reverse order, for over 20 years. And Paul is a long-standing member of the practice committee and is also the chair of the legislation subcommittee. So I'll hand over to these two gentlemen. I think we're starting off with Brad. So thank you, everyone.
Okay, I'll start off first of all and cover the NTC issues and allocations of from reserves, and Paul will cover OTE and benefit certificates, and I've just got one or two slides at the end about, I think, deductibility of contributions. We've got two SEBPC sessions this week, so hopefully don't get them mixed up. Okay. Largely what I want to do is cover, I guess, a fair bit of information that was covered at a recent Insights, but of course Insights are only Sydney-Melbourne centric and not many people could attend on those days. So I do want to cover a fair bit of that information again, because what we're trying to do at the moment with the both these two issues is gather feedback from our members, because this process of consultation with the various government bodies is still ongoing, and we still need a few things that we need to clarify, or quite a few things that we need to clarify. So I'm really actually looking to your feedback. Actually, I might just clarify a point. Feedback. We've got these two sections. Should we do both ours first and then feedback on both of them?
Or all the questions at the end.
Okay, all the questions at the end. So, as I say, I'll cover NTCs, Paul do OT, then joint questions on both topics towards the end, please. So today what I'm going to cover is a quick outline on what's happened to date in terms of our consultations, where we've been successful, where we've still got some work to go, and outline those things that we are still needing to take up with either Treasury or the ATO. First, the sort of good news, bad news, the success stories, what things have happened that we've had some success on. We've had success in sort of half a dozen real areas. You might recall, if you've looked at on the website, that last year we wrote a fairly detailed submission to Treasury and got responses back. Sometimes those responses did indicate there were more things to discuss. So we've had, I guess, two iterations of that throughout 2007. On the sex side, some positive outcomes in relation to benefit categories. We had the ability for the actuary to certify what a benefit category was in relation to certain parts of the Act in Part 1A of the regulations. In relation to the five-member rule, that's an important rule that determines whether how you calculate your NTCs. There are different rules for five or more members, and different rules for less than five members. In determining that, how many DB members you have, that includes not only active employee DB members, but also pensioners, both active and deferred. A non-accruing member, so a member for whom you don't have to report an NTC. Originally in the legislation there was if that person's, I guess, pension was indexed with salary, that was okay, but a lot of our pensions are indexed with a FAS-type approach, so that extension was extended. That ability to use FAS indexation for a non-accruing member was included. Salary tests for the cap eligibility. There's the requirements for 50% or 75% over 3 years. We were concerned that whether it was effectively a continuous test over what period we needed to test those salary increases. We had it clarified that they're basically 30 June years with some allowance for the start of the whole thing on the 5th of September 2006. But that was useful to clarify, to give some certainty as to what salary increases we were needing to check to work out whether the salary cap test had been breached. An important one related to the determination of new entrant ages, the new entrant ages for your NTC calculations, and where you had a fund in the past transfer into another fund. because the requirement was to work out the NTC age at 1 July 07 for members of the fund. It was agreed, it was allowed, that if a fund had transferred into another fund in the past prior to 1 July 2007, that you could use that original entry date of that member in determining the new entrant age, the average new entrant age. In relation to certain discretionary benefits and member options, it was agreed that if you had taken these into account in your valuation, that should those events then occur later on, they didn't give rise to a special and extra amount you needed to include in your NTC. At the end of the paper that we put to Treasury, there were a number of examples, and it was clarified, I guess, that they were the approaches that we had taken those examples were reasonable. So we had a few, I guess, case studies or examples that people could benchmark some of their plans against. So some things went okay. Some things that haven't gone okay yet, and on this slide, LC means legislative change still to be sought, so we still have to go back now with any other questions that we add to the list to clarify. Particular one is in relation to subfunds and determining the new entrant age for a subfund. It's a requirement that all employees be of the same employer. Now, we know for many of our employers that's not the case. Either we've got related or even sometimes unrelated employers in the same subfund, perhaps because from whence they once came they were related, but that's no longer the case. But it's very common to have different employers in the same group within the subfund of a master trust. At present, that falls outside the definition of being able to use the new entrant age for that group of members for that subfund. In relation to the five-member test, you needed to have five members in your fund on 1 July 2007. Well, there's also a provision that if you had more than five members in your fund 5 years earlier, at 1 July 2002, you still could count as being within that having five or more members. The issue, of course, is that we've had lots of fund amalgamations over the last few years. And if there have been amalgamations, say, in 2004 or 2005, then they won't, and they now have less than five members, but they did have five members back in 2003 or 2004, they don't qualify for that treatment that is in the legislation. So they fall foul of that press, basically, and they can't use that requirement, even though they may have had five members back in 2002, but it was just in a predecessor fund. Non-accruing members with an MRB underpin. So what we're referring to here is you've got obviously an MRB underpin. Your main benefit has ceased accruing because you've reached a maximum, but the MRB underpin continues to increase. I guess it was our belief that we shouldn't. Those members should be considered to be non-accruing because their actual benefit wasn't increasing, the benefit that they would be paid. But we didn't win on that battle, and I don't think we're likely to. So we won't be pursuing that one. Also, a lot of our members took exception to the requirement that there was effectively, what we felt, a retrospective imposition you would lose the cap if you change benefit categories from 5 September until the date of the legislation the regulations were released. That wasn't known back in 5 September 2006. So we feel that some members may have inadvertently lost their cap by changing benefit category between 5 September 2006 the day of the regulations. Successive fund transfers. I mentioned before that I guess one success was that in looking back from 1 July 2007, in working out the new entrant age, you could include a predecessor fund if that had happened prior to that date. The concern, though, is that in relation to any future transfers. So there's a couple of issues here. If you transfer into a new fund under a successive fund transfer sometime in the future, you won't actually have had members in that new fund at 1 July 2007, which is the date on which you have to calculate the new entrant age. So our concerns there are that effectively you don't have any members in the fund at that date, or the day before that they transferred in, which means that you would then need to default to using an average new entrant age of 40, and that could be an increase in the NTC depending upon what the entry age was under your original fund. And if that gives rise to an increase in your new entrant rate and your NTC, effectively somebody could lose their cap because they've moved into, they've had an increase in their NTC, so a bit of a double whammy. So we think that's not a good outcome and not really consistent with the approach before 1 July 2007. So we're pretty keen on going back to a Treasury on those issues, and as I said, any other issues that we have had some feedback in from members, both in a couple of insight sessions and just generally. So we'll be looking at those kind of questions. Basically, our next to-do lists are to clarify all those issues and any issues that come up in question time today. We hadn't really concentrated too much on the WXYZ, the extra items that get added to your new entrant rate, if you like, NTC. So there are a few issues around there that we need to clarify. I guess particularly, though, we are concerned with a couple of those mentions, those items that I mentioned on the previous slide, relating to the pension indexation increase. I mean, if we don't get... I don't think actually I mentioned that one, sorry, apologies. If your pension indexation rate has changed since the commencement of your pension, then that extra amount, we're concerned that it would be need to be calculated as a captured as a concessional contribution. So that's a particular concern. If there is a pension increase that's occurred, the increase in the indexation rate, does it give rise to an extra benefit, an extra W, or is it counted as an X or a Y in the calculation? We prefer neither, of course. The successor fund transfers, that could hamper amalgamations of funds in the future. So that's a pretty important one. And the inadvertent loss of cap is sort of like a hidden one that's not terribly well known. So that's some of the things on our to-do list. As I mentioned, when we get to the end of Paul's section, I'd really encourage you to think about in the next few minutes, if you haven't done so already, some other issues that you might have come across in your practical experience with your funds. I guess related to the NTC issue is the allocations from reserves. There was quite, I think, some confusion about allocations from reserves when we made our initial submission to the to Treasury and got the response back. We've been waiting for some time now to get a draft consultation paper from Treasury because we wish to give, I guess, our input and our help in formulating their guidance. But that hasn't happened as yet, and we're still pursuing them. In looking at this issue of allocations from reserves and what's in the NTCs, thanks. We have to obviously read this in conjunction with SIS, because SIS requires unallocated contributions to a reserve for an accumulation interest, of course, to be allocated. The idea is that generally allocations from reserves will be concessional contributions. I guess that's the principle, that a reserve can't be used as a device to avoid reporting of concessional contributions. In the legislation, there is an exemption in Section 292.2501.4, if you've studied the legislation, I'm sure that number comes flooding back to you. But what it says, in case it doesn't, is that basically there are some exceptions. That says that if the amount is allocated, I guess paraphrasing it a little bit, in a fair and reasonable manner, either to an account for every member of the plan or to an account for every member of a class within a plan, and the reserve rate slot relates solely to that class, that the amount, if the amount is less than 5% of a member's interest at the time of allocation, then you don't need to include it as a concessional contribution. When I read that back just now, that sounds pretty straightforward to me, but having tried to apply in practice, I've come across quite a few problems, and I don't know if anybody else has as well. I mean, some of the issues that we think we need to clarify of these things passing through reserves, unallocated contributions passing to reserves and being allocated allocated to members. So we ought to obviously make sure that we avoid any double counting of contributions that pass through a reserve. If somehow a contribution is going into a reserve and because of CIS, it's in respect of a member and therefore needs to be counted as a concessional contribution, that when it passes through that reserve out the other side, it can't be double counted. Indeed, another concern, of course, is that reserving is sometimes used in smoothing of interest rates. If that's still a pretty prevalent practice, but if you're using reserves to smooth interest rates, any allocation that was of purely investment returns, that even if it was more than 5%, surely should not be something that gives rise to a concessional contribution. I guess we'd like some clarity around the issue of the 5% test and what, I guess, fair and reasonable means. Or is it to be something left entirely to actuaries to judge as fair and reasonable, in which case we need to provide some guidance? Or is there any guidance that the Treasury would like to put around what fair and reasonable means? Given that we've got a test that's based on a member's interest, then an allocation in relation to a proportion of that member's interest would seem to be something that I would infer as fair and reasonable, but there can be other bases. If you're allocating something that you wish to use to cover administration or group life costs, some sort of basis related to salaries or the underlying costs of those benefits would seem more appropriate. I must have been a bit confused about the whole issue of the surplus that accrued before Better Super came into existence, how something that comes out of that could possibly be caught. Issues related to grossing up. I mean, of course, we know that if a contribution per se is being met out of a surplus, we should gross it up by dividing it by 0.85 or multiplying by 1.176. But there can be other things that might come through a reserve. Contributions that an employer doesn't have to make on the distribution related to a wind-up. What are the grossing requirements there, grossing up requirements? Indeed, legitimate uses of the reserve. We use reserves for many things. It could be, for example, that we're passing the proceeds of a death benefit through a reserve, from the insurance proceeds to the reserve and then the payment to the member. Even if it's self-insurance, even if it's things that might pass through the reserves for correcting errors or... I understand these things happen from time to time. Unit pricing errors might occur, and that we might be able to need to use those reserves to make that restitution. Would that not give rise to a concessional contribution? So there are lots of legitimate uses of reserves, and we don't want to make sure that those things aren't captured. So I guess we've got a list of things that we'd like to add to, and we'd particularly like to actually Treasury to acknowledge our dialogue request. That's what I would like to cover on the NTCs. As I say, I'd be thinking about your questions. And then when Paul's finished his section on OTE and the SG, we'll get back into those as well.
Thanks, Brett. Beautiful. So I go without the glasses. Yes, this afternoon I wanted to run through just where we're at with legislation and guidance, some examples of the minimum requisite benefit designs that we think should be allowable for satisfying superannuation guarantee requirements under the new ordinary time earnings base. Some particular issues arise with fully defined benefit MRBs, and I wanted to mention some of the averaging data issues that arise. Much of what I'm going to discuss is alluded to in the discussion that was issued in April. I'm sure you've all studied that very carefully, but I will come off on some of those issues, and we'll be looking, as Brad says, for your comments and any other issues that have arisen for you in your practice in relation to this area. Also wanted to touch on some issues associated with the administration of the maximum contribution base. And finally, we'll finish with the discussion. So, firstly, dealing with the legislation and guidance issues. It's now 4 years since the super guarantee legislation was changed to introduce the ordinary time earnings base, or effectively what it was doing was removing the ability to use the grandfathered earnings base And that was to happen from 1st of July 2008. We all thought, gee, that's 4 years away, that's plenty of time. But amazingly enough, it's almost here, and not only have we got lots of employers that aren't prepared for it, but we still haven't got the regulations through on the changes for defined benefits, and in particular the preparation of benefit certificates. We actually did have a consultation period on a draft of the regulations, which finishes today, I think. So hopefully we'll see them shortly. The Institute has been quite involved in preparation of draft regulations for 10 or 12 months now. It seems to have been through a torturous process in various areas. In terms of the Institute guidance, the discussion note, if you like, is a bit of a first step in preparing a full professional standard relating to preparation of benefit certificates. The existence guidance note, 456, is due, I guess, to be turned into a professional standard. That we think is going to take a number of months. So what actuaries need to do for the time being is to use a combination, I guess, of the discussion note and guidance note 456 in working through these issues. Our expectation is that the professional standard will be very much reflective of what's in those two pieces of guidance, or even though the discussion note is not formally guidance, and we wouldn't expect, if you're doing things which are consistent with what's in there, that you would fall foul of the professional standard. Turning then to different types of minimum requisite benefit designs that will be allowable, what we're expecting to see in the regulations when they come out, as you might be aware, the structure of the regulations in regard to benefit certificates or defined benefit designs is in the regulations there is a what's called the standard minimum requisite benefit design. And if you're familiar with that one, that formula might look fairly familiar to you. In practice, the design that's actually in the regulations is covers a very narrow case, and it wouldn't apply to any fund in practice, I wouldn't think. But what the Institute does is to say, here's a design which is authorised by legislation, and we can then use that as a basis to provide guidance to actuaries through our professional standards as to what is a basis which is consistent with this or with what's in the regulations, but which can actually be applied more flexibly in practice. So the existing defined benefit MRB has two components, which are the pre-92, and at the moment there's a post-92 component, which uses pretty much a formula like this, but only has salary in it. So what we will see under the new regulations is that there'll be that will be broken up into three components. The pre-92 will stay pretty much the same. The component between 92 and 2008 can very much mirror what's already there. And the purpose for having that separate component is so that we maintain this discount factor. You'll note the pre-92 component doesn't have a discount factor in it. So if we were to combine those into one factor, the discount factor would fall out. So people wouldn't get the benefit of an increasing age discount factor. So that's a deliberate process there to include three components rather than arguably keeping it simple and using two components. The top component is a new one, and you'll see on the far left side, or your right side, the NECR, the employer contribution rate, is now to be applied to ordinary time earnings. And in practice, we'd expect that to be in the main an average ordinary time earnings. There may be I guess some cases where someone's purely getting a base salary and no other items fall into ordinary time earnings. In that case, I guess you've really got no change from the old to the new. But in a lot of cases, there are non-recurrent single-off items such as bonuses, which are in ordinary time earnings, and hence the notion of a point in time OT is not terribly relevant. In the standard formula, when it emerges, you might see that it refers to a member contribution rate being on ordinary time earnings. Again, that will be an unusual circumstance, and more usually we would expect to see this top component broken into two bits, where the member contribution rate continues to apply to salary, and it's only the employer NECR which applies to OTE. Okay. Turning then to accumulation minimum requisite benefits. The approach here could be a fully accumulation minimum requisite benefit, or to use an add-on minimum requisite benefit to the existing defined benefit MRB based on salary. So approach A is to get rid of all the past MRB, crystallise it into a single figure, roll forward with future member contributions and employer contributions on OTE and use an accumulation basis going forward. The alternative add-on approach is to say, look, we'll keep our existing defined benefit MRB on salary. That will roll on as it is. And adding on to that will be a 9% contribution on the difference between ordinary time earnings and salary. That will add on to the standard defined benefit minimum requisite benefit. So two common approaches that are being used. In some cases, the accumulation add-on will be just to the minimum requisite benefit, and in other cases, it might add on to all the benefits. So, for example, the second approach is commonly used where there's a bonus. Someone's entitled to $10,000 bonus. $1,000 arguably has to go into super, and the other $9,000 they can have in cash. A common approach is to have that $1,000 go into an additional accumulation. That gets added on to all benefits, not just the minimum requisite benefit. In either case, the amount of contributions and the timing for interest purposes should be consistent with the requirements for accumulation funds. So what we mean there is that contributions, for example, should be based on actual ordinary time earnings, not on average or an estimate or anything like that. They should be based on actually ordinary time earnings for the period. And secondly, that contributions should be credited at least quarterly on a basis that ensures that members get a fair deal in regard to the interest on their contributions in the minimum requisite benefit. Moving on now to some of the issues that arise if you want to have a fully defined benefit, minimum requisite benefit, based on ordinary time earnings. It wouldn't be news to any of you that where you've got significantly fluctuating items, it's not a ready-made a situation to use defined benefits. So if you're basing the defined benefit on a multiple of ordinary time earnings, and that can fluctuate very significantly from year to year, then you need to consider whether that's an appropriate mechanism to use. In some cases, an averaging approach might help to reduce the fluctuations that might occur. Whether that's a 12 months will probably generally not be enough in a lot of cases to even out fluctuations. So you could be needing to use a 2 or 3 or longer period, averaging period, to try and reduce the chance that you are going to have reductions in final average salary or in the ordinary time earnings that you're using in this minimum requisite benefit. The current guidance note does specifically say that if there are that reductions in minimum requisite benefits can occur where there's a reduction in salary. And the guidance that we expect to put forward in the professional standard, we don't expect to say that reductions in MRBs due to reductions in OT will not be permitted. However, the existing guidance does say also that the actuary needs to consider the sort of circumstances which may occur, including salary reductions, and to take that into account in the formulation of the minimum requisite benefit. So I think it's incumbent on us in designing these to try and minimise the situations where that sort of thing can occur. Having regard to the difficulties that some employers are having with providing data. If you've been consulting with employers, you'll find that they're throwing their hands up in the air and saying, we can't give you anything at all in regard to ordinary time earnings, and we certainly don't want to go back over 2 or 3 or 5 years to give you averages which you can use to try and reduce the fluctuations. So one of the methods which we believe will be allowable and which is discussed in the discussion note is to use an average of the 12 months earnings to the previous review date or birth date, for example, and that that will perhaps make administration a bit easier for some of in moving to an OT type base. That has its own difficulties in that collection of data can be, you can get into complex situations where effectively for this to work nicely, you need really a full-time equivalent ordinary time earnings. That's pretty straightforward for full-time workers, but as soon as you get into part-time, as you get questions of how do you calculate an equivalent full-time earnings, full-time rate of ordinary time earnings. As an example, if someone gets a bonus in this year and they were 50% part-time last year, do you double that bonus if they're now a full-time person? So there's some pretty sneaky sort of things that start to come into play with using ordinary time earnings, which I guess leads to the last point that I think actuaries need to be careful that clients understand the potential for anomalies to occur and are able to accept, I guess, any shortcomings in the methodology which is adopted. I think there's a tendency for sometimes the most convenient administrative option to be used and for actuaries or others to be blamed when problems occur later on because clients haven't sort of been looking forward to see what practical problems might emerge. And as we all know, that sometimes you put these things in place for an interim period until you figure out a good solution, and 16 years later you find you've got a minimum requisite benefit that's been there since you put it in temporarily 16 years ago. We're running out of time, are we? Okay. Maximum contribution space. This is a very sneaky one. I guess it's effectively what the discussion note is saying, where we're using an accumulation style minimum requisite benefit, then we need to be consistent with an accumulation fund. So we can apply a limit of 9% of the maximum contribution space, which currently is about $14,000 a quarter, is it? So it works out to be about $3,000 a quarter is the maximum contribution if you wanted to limit it to that. Some people have taken an easy route and say, look, we'll just divide the quarterly figure by three and we'll pay that on a monthly basis. And then they find that for the guy who left in the second month, they've restricted the contributions and they haven't met the super guarantee for him. The same thing applies for a person who joins in June and they only make an insufficient contribution in the June quarter. So what we found is that it requires often a fair bit of manual intervention for people to operate the maximum contribution base properly, and so often it's not done at all, or it's done on a bit of an ad hoc basis. With defined benefit style MRBs, on the other hand, it's really only practical to use an annualised earnings base. It really only works given that you're going to cap the earnings to which you apply the super guarantee multiple. So the current guidance allows the annualised earnings base to be capped, and there's no adjustment required to in partial quarters if you're using maximum contributions based with a DB style MRB. Now, that different treatment can lead to some complexity where, for example, you take the accumulation add-on approach, you've got your existing defined benefit based on salary minimum, and you're doing an add-on accumulation, it can create some complexity in how you apply that maximum contribution base across the two items. And there's an example in the discussion note if you want to have a look at that. Just to finish up, Brad mentioned the defined benefit grandfathering or the eligibility for the cap on notional contributions. And one of the issues there is that you can lose it on doing 25 different things that you're not allowed to do. One of the things you're not allowed to do is improve benefits or change salaries, but each of those is a get-out clause, and that's where you're only doing the change to satisfy a legislative requirement. And so the question arises then, I'm going to change my earnings base to ordinary time earnings. What does that mean for the cap? And I think it's pretty clear if you're doing the minimum you need to with applying the ordinary time earnings and applying, say if you used an accumulation add-on, you're just adding on the bit that you need to add on to satisfy ordinary time earnings. There's no retrospective impact. I think it's pretty clear there that it wouldn't affect the cap. If you were to apply that formula we first looked at, the defined benefit formula, you said, well, I'm going to go from an accrued SG multiple times salary to an accrued SG multiple times OTE, that could have a very significant retrospective impact. And I think it's probably harder to sustain the argument that it was necessary to do that as a result of a legislative requirement. So that one I don't think we've really got any strong guides on, but it's something you probably need to be aware of in advising clients about the OTE issue. Replacing non-OTE benefit certificates, the discussion note makes the point that any existing benefit certificates out there, if they run past 30th of June and are not on an OTE earnings base, then they need to be replaced by a new certificate with effect from 1st of July. The other thing to be aware of is that in terms of timing, a certificate can only be issued in hindsight. That is, you can't issue it in advance of the date. So a certificate taking effect from 1st of July, you can't sign that certificate until 1st of July or after. So nothing to stop you issuing draft certificates in the meantime, but you cannot issue a certificate in advance. That's a legislative requirement. And finally, a reminder that issuing a new benefit certificate will usually trigger a requirement to replace the funding insolvency certificate. So perhaps we've got to finish there and open up to discussion.
Okay, thanks, Brad and Paul. Any questions on either of those items from the floor? Some fairly technical stuff we got into at various parts there, so are there any questions that you want clarified?
Go on. It's hard to know which particular issue you might be talking about there, Dan.
The National Taxable Contributions one has been a very difficult birth, and I'm not sure the Labor has finished yet. There are lots of things still to be fixed up with that, and they don't apply to lots of funds, but they're still extremely annoying. I mean, we've had instances in the last few weeks where we have had a successor fund transfer and there's been, problems because of the way the legislation doesn't allow for those things to occur, and there were some senior people involved that could have lost eligibility for the cap. And the whole question of proceeding with the transfer was in doubt until we resolved that question. So some of these things are very important to resolve, but it's hard to get attention of the people who are going to make decisions on this. Treasury thinks it's all finished. Tax is saying we can't interpret the current legislation to mean what, we sort of agree probably it should mean, but practically the words aren't consistent with that interpretation. So we need to
it's still in our court, I guess, to follow that through and see what we can resolve. But I can't be very optimistic that it's going to be resolved that quickly, based on past history.
Is there any other questions from the floor? There's... No, he's leaving. Here's John.
John Warden. I think one of the most urgent issues is the combination of the NPC.
I agree entirely, John. And that's one we've wrestled with as well. At the moment, I'm taking the pessimistic attitude that I lost a cap in that situation. But I'm not saying that it's not on the issues of things that we are still going to go back and fight for.
You mentioned before that you can't replace an MR certificate until 1 July. What's the deadline again?
14th of November to issue.
This year. So it has to be issued by 14th of November this year. And there's a number of things that still require that sort of clarification.
Just while there, I might quickly mention two little... There was actually a small third topic on the end there, just in case you feel you've been shortchanged, which was contributions for pensioners. In 30 seconds, all this was is you're probably aware that tax deductibility for employer contributions is generally restricted to contributions in respect of current employees. You know, there's wording in the Tax Act about, you know, they've got to be engaged in producing accessible income and the like. There's limited deductibility for former employees. And that was noted last year in a Senate Standing Committee for Economics report. And we saw that and we sort of picked up on the thought that, we're glad that they identified a shortcoming, but they seem to think it was a shortcoming in relation to, say, contributions being a month or two late. But then we started putting that together with, well, we have got lots of shrinking defined benefit arrangements with somewhere that's shrinking in terms of their active membership, but with large pensioner bases. And hey, we might get to a situation soon where we just need to be making contributions in respect of pensioners. But at the moment, that's not tax deductible. So that's not a very good situation. So we did put in submission, which was on the 6th of December, to Treasury, requesting basically that any contributions in respect of former employees, if they're made in the last 12 months, or any contribution to fund a defined benefit pension, should be deductible. We noted that there would need to be some related amendments to CIS, for example, to allow funds to accept such contributions. So that's another one that we're still waiting on and pursuing with Treasury, I think. Sometimes I get that mixed up between Treasury and ATO. No,
Christine, you wouldn't get those concerns.
Sorry about that. Sorry. I may have said that before when I said Treasury meant ATO. I'll correct that.
And any of you that advise SMSS will probably have the same situation that arise too, where you've got someone drawing a pension, which could become less well-funded than it should be. APRA wants them to get it funded, but the legislation won't put... In fact, in some cases, illegal to actually put any more money in, because they've now reached 65, they aren't working any more at all, and so forth, they actually can't contribute to the fund, yet they've got not enough assets to pay the pension that's been promised.
So that question goes to whether their ability to give advice sort of thing and how close they are to the wind there. I can only talk from my experience with a few of my clients who I guess are conscious of the issue, are taking, I guess, the approach that they'll provide the facts, as in, here's your NTC number, here's your limit, the consequences of gold over a limit are X, and then leave it at that.
Yeah, this is an interesting one for employers, because on the one hand, they want to try and do the right thing by employees, but they also don't want to bear responsibility for it. So they get caught in a bit of a cleft stick where they say it's all your problem, but then the superannuation manager will check on the 20 top earners and say, oh, hang on, you're getting a bit close. And so they get into that sort of no man's land. The short answer is, Bill, no, the committee's not planning to do anything about that.
Got time for one more question before afternoon tea, which we don't have to go to. We actually have finished the session early rather than running over. So any one last chance? Okay. Well, thanks for coming to the session today. It was, I think, what the comment that you made before was completely valid, that there are completing interests here. simplicity versus protecting the interests of those that you're trying to protect when they're making changes like this. And in these cases, usually simplicity loses out, as you've noticed today. So some very complex areas. Thanks, Brad and Paul, for your presentations today.